When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Franz, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time for this.
Of course.
I have many questions about that live tour and many more, but we got to start by getting to the truth about all the rumors. Is it true that the only reason Attila exists is because Franz got rich from suing a sushi restaurant?
Oh, of course, man. Duh. No, that's actually a really funny rumor, and I'm glad to finally debunk it. But the story of the salmonella sushi, first of all, salmonella is the worst thing that could ever happen to anyone. I don't wish that upon my worst enemy. But long story short, early days of Attila, we're on tour. I ate some sushi at a place that I'd been to before, but the supplier of the sushi, it turns out, was storing the tuna in like non-refrigerated areas with rats and rat poop everywhere. So I got extremely sick. And funny thing, this is when like Twitter was new, and that's actually how I found out about it, because someone like tweeted at me and was like, hey, I think you're sick because maybe this salmonella outbreak because of this tuna. And I put it all together and freaked out.
Thanks to Dr. Twitter.
Yeah, probably the only good thing to come up with Twitter, to be honest. But I ended up kind of piecing things together, and I found a really good food lawyer that was really excited about representing me. But I think that's the biggest misconception, is because people think that I got some like massive fortune. And I will say that as an extremely broke young touring Franzilla, the money that I got, it was helpful, but without giving away a number, it wasn't even like enough money to buy a car. You know, it was a small
pay rent for a couple months.
Yeah, it was,
which
it
helps when you're like grinding like that.
Yeah, so the rumor is not true. The sushi, the lawsuit I won from the tainted sushi, did not provide me riches or anything. If anything, like you said, it provided maybe a couple months of living expenses, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm disappointed. I was hoping that one was going to be true, but it's all downhill from here. Yeah.
I was hoping it was true too. I'd love to be super rich.
All right. Well, you're kicking off the 10th anniversary tour of About That Life soon, which in all seriousness, I think is like legitimately a masterpiece. I was blown away by that album when it came out. I still think it's great. I listened to it again before this interview. I legitimately love it. How do you feel about it looking back on it now, a decade later?
I love it. I think that what About That Life did for the scene was something that needed to happen. It really shocked people. I don't know. I always wonder if some bands look back on their older stuff and they don't really like it, because for me,
I think a lot of them do. Yeah.
That's so strange. For me, I love everything we've done, and the About That Life album, I still to this day love it. And most of the songs on that album are in our regular touring set anyways. So I love that album. That album was pivotal.
It's interesting you said that it did something that the scene needed, which, you know, looking back on it, 2013 was kind of, to me, really when things started getting super serious and kind of uptight. You know, Tumblr started getting really big and all the bands started making the like black and white merch and all that stuff, which is cool. I liked a lot of that stuff, but it's kind of like, guys, remember, like, we're here to have fun.
Exactly. And at the time, there was nothing edgy, nothing pushing buttons. Everything was pretty stale, to be honest, and everything kind of sounded similar. But I think that About That Life is by far like the most interesting experience I've ever experienced. Cause the biggest thing I always tell people about that album is when we dropped About That Life, I've never seen so much hatred in my life, and all across the board, like,
yeah,
everybody hated it. And
it was
every
like
single...
Broken Side. It was that same level of like hatred.
Yeah. And every single news outlet from AP, Revolver, it doesn't matter what it was.
Yeah.
Every article was just like worst metal album ever.
Yeah.
Worst album ever created. This sucks. Like, this is dog shit. And it was crazy because it was about 3 to 4 months after the release of About That Life where something just clicked and everyone decided they loved it.
Like, and actually, this is great.
Yeah. And it was the most like confusing thing to my brain because I was just processing all of this hate and I was like, damn, I guess no one likes it like we like it. And then it was like something just flipped and it flipped. I'll never forget the moment that it flipped because it was right in the middle of Warped Tour.
And really quick, before we go any further, have you checked out my Patreon? Patrons get early access to all my main channel videos and my podcasts. I also do giveaways sometimes. For example, I just gave away a pair of these Eargasm earplugs. And if you want me to review your music, there's a way to do that as well. All you gotta do is join at the $10 and up level. Then every month I do a call for submissions. If you want me to review something, all you gotta do is drop it in the comments of that post. Then I will review it live on Twitch and post it on Patreon for everyone to see. So if that sounds cool, hit the link in the description of this video and I appreciate your support.
So this is 2014 or it might have been 2013 actually, but it's right in the middle of Warped Tour. It was our first Warped Tour ever and we were only supposed to do the first half of Warped Tour and because that's all we got offered. And then a couple days before we were supposed to drop off Warped, Kevin Lyman walks up to us because at this point About That Life out of nowhere just blew up to the moon. And he walks up to us and he's like, look, guys, I really need you guys to stay on Warped Tour like this. You know, can you guys just do the whole tour? And we already had plans. So we just looked at him and said, hey, sorry, but we got to go because we already have another tour planned. And then that's kind of when it clicked. And he was like, well, next year you're doing the full tour. And we were just like, sweet, cool.
I mean, I'm sure you expected, you know, the hate because obviously, you know, you said a lot of ridiculous stuff on purpose. Were you stoked on it? Did it feel bad at the same time? How did you feel about that?
It was very like mixed emotions because at that point I was kind of used to the hate, but I hadn't seen hate on that level. So it was a new level of hate, but I think what made it strange to me is, like I said, after this massive wave of hate, and we didn't have a single positive press article about this album. Right. And so after this massive wave of hate, there was this huge resurgence of popularity. So it was mentally confusing to me, but I could see like our crowds growing, growing, growing. Everyone's singing along to all the songs. And I think it was very rewarding because I knew it was a good album when we wrote it. I knew it was a good album when we released it, but it took everyone a few months to, I guess, digest it and realize that they liked it.
I mean, there's always that disconnect between what the media likes, which is, you know, old, uptight men, and
yeah,
what the kids like, you know, younger people and women and stuff like that that aren't really represented in the media. And by the way, a lot of girls loved Attila back then.
Oh, yeah.
And
they still do.
Right. But you know what I mean? Like that was a dynamic that I think I've seen this happen so many times that basically if young people and especially young women like something, the media hates it.
Yep. You're right. And I think the biggest takeaway that I got from it is I think if it wasn't for all the negative media and the super hateful press we got, I don't think the album would be as big because if you think about it,
people have even known about it?
Yeah. And if all these major news outlets were just to post Attila releases a new album About That Life, it's awesome.
Who cares?
No one's going to click that. But if everyone's posting worst album of the decade, like this sucks, everyone's going to click it and listen. So I think just the overwhelming hate drove everyone to the album to be like, what the fuck's wrong with this album? Why is it so bad? And then they realized they liked it.
What's interesting to me, I remember you guys kind of starting to bubble with like Rage and especially Outlawed. But About That Life was when you really kind of blew up. but it wasn't super different than anything you had been doing before. It was like better, but it wasn't like necessarily different. Do you think there's anything specific that you did that made it catch on the way it did?
So I think it definitely was the same Attila formula, just supercharged. And
it's quite a bit better.
Yeah, it's a lot better. And I would say about that life was when we started incorporating a lot of rap and hip hop influence. Mm-hmm. And at the time, like now it's the most popular thing is to have rap and metal. But at the time in 2013, it wasn't popular or ever
nobody
done.
Did that.
It wasn't done before. So we started incorporating a lot of the trap beats, a lot of the rapping and whatnot. So
and just
the
vibe.
Yeah, and the vibe. And I think that was a big part of it.
The video for About That Life is still to this day one of the best, most amazing, ridiculous videos of all time. I was laughing my ass off when I saw it. But it's like it's legitimately great at the same time. Where did that come from?
So that's actually a funny story. So the producers that made the About That Life video had never made a rock or metal music video before. Oh. They were strictly rap and hip hop. And the way it all came together was actually interesting because last minute, the location that we were supposed to film at fell through. So we were screwed. We had nowhere to film this video. And then what had happened is a friend of the band, I forgot her name, but someone in my band was friends with this girl, and the girl's parents had this mansion in Atlanta and they were out of town. And so she was like, we could film here. Who cares? So we just scored and got lucky out of nowhere and pull up to this mansion with these hoopties and stuff and just start ripping this awesome music video. It kind of all just came together out of luck, I guess.
Did you have like all the concept and shot list and stuff figured out, or did that just happen on the fly, or what?
Most of it was kind of figured out. And that's kind of why we went with a rap producer, is because we wanted a really over the top hip hop video.
Right. What did he think of the song and everything?
They loved it. Everyone loved it and everyone had a good time, and it was a party. Everyone was just smoking blunts the whole time, and it was wild.
When you had that song and especially the video done, did you know what you had?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew it was good and I knew it was going to be like our best video like that we had so far, but I didn't realize how big it would get. Not at all. Even when we recorded the album, because about that, Outlawed and Rage are great albums, but they never caused us to blow up. So in my head, I'm just like, okay, this is a great album. I love it. It's better than anything we've done, but I don't really know what to expect. So I everything about that album was a surprise to me and the band.
One thing that I think maybe people miss about that album, and especially that song, is like, it's a really fucking good song. Like, obviously there's the shock value of the lyrics and the imagery and all that stuff, but it's like catchy as fuck. Like, it's just legitimately a great song with like tons and tons of hooks.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. It is good. I love it. I love that whole album front to back. It's great.
I would say of that whole era, maybe the best lyric is in that song. She counts my money while I'm on my PlayStation. I still laugh every time I hear it.
Oh yeah. I think the goal for that album was just to kind of be over the top. And I think to understand the album too, something I wanted to talk about, I think it helps to understand the setting, the scenery and the environment and where we all were at. So at this point, we had already recorded with Joey Sturgis before, and Joey Sturgis in the past, like when we did Outlawed, lived in a very tiny, like basically trailer in Indiana in the middle of
his old studio.
His old studio, in the middle of a cornfield. But this, About That Life, was right when he had just moved into a crazy huge mansion in, I think it was Royal Oaks, Michigan.
Yeah.
And so none of us in the band had ever like been in a crazy mansion or house like that. We were kind of in our young, crazy party phase. And then you just put us in this mansion with like heated wood floors and all this like expensive stuff. So we're up there and we're just partying every day, going wild. My guitarist got arrested and went to jail during the middle of recording. Like, all kinds of crazy things are happening. And, you know, it feels like we're in this badass mansion, and it feels like we're like, I don't know, something about
your Scarface moment.
Yeah, it was like a Scarface moment. And I think that had a lot of influence on the album. Was just the environment we were in, the kind of headspace we were in, where we were very carefree. We had nothing to worry about at that point in our lives. No big stressors. It was just like, we're here to party in this mansion and make this fucking album and do whatever the fuck we want. And it kind of, that energy got captured in About That Life.
Is being from Atlanta like a part of all that, you know, just being around like hip hop culture and stuff so much, especially like the Southern hip hop culture?
Very much so. And that's why Attila has that sound that we do, is very much because, when I was growing up, I just had FM radio. And when you're growing up in Atlanta, every single station is rap. There's nothing right. But hip hop and rap. So I, rather than deciding to be against it or not like it, I just fully embraced it and fell in love with the music. And I think what happened is I got introduced to hard rock, heavy metal, and I loved the way that I loved the energy of rap and hip hop, but I liked how hard like heavy metal hit. So yeah. It made perfect sense in my mind to combine the two genres, even though no one had been doing it at the time.
I forget if we talked about this before, but I think with that album in particular, you really kind of came into your own or sort of hit a new level as a vocalist. And I think, I'm sorry, this is just an interview of me kissing your ass, but I'm just going to do it. That's what we're here for. But I think you're a very underrated vocalist. I think even now with, you know, all the like crazy deathcore vocal stuff that's going on, I still don't really think that there's anybody that does exactly what you do. And
thank you.
How do you feel about that?
I agree 100%. And it comes from a place of confidence, not douchey cockiness, but yeah. My whole reason for being a vocalist in the first place was the lack of creativity within metal vocalists, because I started Attila in 2004. And at that time, I'll use an example, and in no way am I talking shit, but like Unearth, right?
Yeah.
Great band, but the vocals are so damn boring.
Not like, a lot I of could, dynamics there.
No dynamic, same vocal tone, same vocal patterns on every song. That's kind of what inspired me to be a vocalist, is because when I hear heavy metal music, I hear intricate patterns and different ranges, you know, keep people guessing. So right. my whole goal to even become a vocalist was to be the most diverse vocalist possible. So I agree with you. And I think deathcore is having a huge resurgence of popularity, and it's cool. I like it too. I just think, I think a lot of it is kind of stale, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you could put like five or six of the top deathcore songs next to each other, and you can't really tell like which vocalist is which. You could copy and paste
parts from one song to the other and it wouldn't make a difference.
Yeah. And I'm stoked for all my friends that are big deathcore vocalists, because everything is getting really popular right now, but it's not too many vocalists out there. Can you hear their personality in their vocals, you know?
And it's not catchy. I think what you have is like that. I'll say it's a pop sensibility, which probably sounds weird to people, but you have a lot of hooks in your music, and you know, you can sing along to a lot of Attila songs, which is not really the case for a lot of stuff.
Agreed. And I think that's kind of where I've heard people say that we were a gateway band for them getting into metal, is because, you know, an average listener is going to listen to metal and just say, it's a lot of screaming, I don't understand it. Whereas Attila came out and you could maybe not understand all of it, but there's parts you can understand enough to keep you hooked in and kind of get you introduced to metal.
I mean, Suicide Silence was that too, you know. You can't understand most of what he's saying, but you hear pull the trigger, bitch, and
you only live once.
Yeah, you get enough, you know, you get these snippets here and there that you can sing along with and latch onto it. And you know, right or wrong, the human brain, like, we respond to vocals more than anything else.
Yeah.
If you can sing along to something, that's what makes a song stick for most people.
You're absolutely right.
And, you know, respect to the vocal gymnastics people. I get it. It's cool. But I think aside from the shock factor of like, holy shit, this person can do that with their voice, I don't know that they're necessarily great songs.
Yeah. I mean, look at what's happening now. So a good friend of mine, Will Ramos, he crafted this style that is unmistakably him. But then, you know, he does this crazy animal noise, right? And all of a sudden, I shit you not, I've heard five other vocalists copy it. And
with
it's like
the same breakdown with the same symphonic shit, with the fucking jets of flame in the background. It's like, guys, we already have one fucking Will. We already have one Lorna Shore. We don't need 100 more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, it shows how much lack of creativity there is with other people where they hear something and they're like, I'm going to copy what Will did. It's like, let Will have his fucking thing. You know, everyone doesn't need to copy just because you see someone does this noise and it gets popular. And I think that's where, like, in heavy music, a lot of there's a lack of creativity is because people don't really think outside of the box.
I mean, that was the death of crabcores. Like, everyone's like, oh, Attack Attack and the Devil Wears Prada, let's fucking run that into the ground and make 100 albums that sound like that. And then everyone's like, I'm sick of this shit, and it died.
Yep. And then the Architects wave, everyone's like, holy shit, like, let's sound like Architects. And it's like, we don't need 50 bands that sound like Architects. Let them have their limelight. Like,
great band, but we already have Architects. We don't need another one.
Exactly.
Well, another thing that people, many, many, many people asked me to ask you about, I have to ask about it, is Made, because people bring this up so much. And for some reason, I've seen it before, but I can't find it online anywhere. How did that happen, and how do you feel about it now?
So that's a good question, and I get asked that a lot too. So the story goes like this. I mean, obviously, growing up in the early 2000s, MTV Made was the best show. Like, everyone loved that show. I was hooked on it, and I watched all the episodes. So what happened is I went to a high school in a suburb of Atlanta called Mill Creek High School, and Made came to my school and did open auditions. So I didn't even have to go anywhere or send a video in. I just had to step up from the lunch table and walk to a room and audition. So I'm at the lunch table with all my friends. I'm like 14, 15 at the time. And I'm just like, hey, do you guys dare me to go audition and be on Made? And we kind of just all chatted about it at the lunch table. And I'm like, well, I'm just a big hairy metal dude. Like, they're not going to pick me if I say that I want to be in a famous metal band, because I'm already like in a band. I have to pick something that's polar opposite of what I am. So I was like, I'm going to pick that I want to be a male model, and I bet I can get them to pick me. And I felt it. Like, I knew I could get them to pick me. And I started like thinking about ideas in my head during my interview that'll make them pick me. So I step off from the lunch table, walk into this interview room, and the camera starts rolling, and they're like, all right, tell us what you want to be made into. Tell us about yourself. And I was just like, I'm Chris Fronczak, and I want to be made into a male model. And then I did a model walk and tripped over a chair and fell. And I just heard like silence, like the silence of like, this is the one.
Yeah. Right.
And then I just knew at that moment they were going to pick me. And so I ended up having to do like a second audition. And they sent someone to me to like follow me, I guess, for a day or two. And then ultimately they ended up picking me, but it was like a year or so process of getting everything in order. It's crazy, by the way, when you're on reality TV, they have to send you to a psychiatrist and get this intense evaluation to make sure you're not going to kill yourself. Because they know that they're going to mentally like torture me. So they're just
make
like,
you look like an asshole on TV.
Yeah. They're like, okay, we're going to send you to the psychiatrist. Like, cause we're going to really fuck with your head, and we need to make sure you're not going to suicide or something.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. So I went through the whole process, finally got approved, and then started filming when I was 16. And that was that. I'll never forget when the episode aired, me and all my friends and all my family just all huddled up on the couch, like watching. And the other interesting thing that I tell people is That was in the MySpace days when MySpace was getting really popular and cool. So the first thing I did is after the episode aired, and I think this was like 2006, I ran to my computer, dial up, boop, 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 logged into MySpace. And I just saw my followers like thousands per second. Like, and it blew my mind. I was like, this is so cool.
Hey there, I'm Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
And for some reason, I can't find it anywhere. There's a lot of people that are like, oh, Franz doesn't want it out there. He took all the videos down. Is that true?
No, I hope. So here's something I've been thinking about. We have Catfish and all these other shows available on streaming. So why isn't Made on streaming?
I think there's something about like the contract they had with the production company or something, because none of the Viacom stuff from like 2004 to 2008 is on any stream, like none of those shows.
Yeah. Like, and that's what's
Cribs,
weird to me.
Next.
Pimp My Ride.
None of that stuff is on streaming. It's only the later seasons from like 2012 that nobody cares about. So I think it's some kind of legal thing.
It's got to be something, because I myself would love if they put my episode on streaming, because it would blow up. It'd be huge.
I would pay $1,000 to be able to watch all those shows from like that era, because that was the best fucking era of TV. I love all that shit.
Hands down. But the only way to watch it is if you know me or my parents, because my parents have a DVD in their house of the episode, and that's it.
Okay, so go over to your parents' house and they'll show it to you.
Knock on the door, say, hey, Mr. Franzak, I'm here to watch MTV Made.
Okay, we'll do it. Another thing I wanted to ask you about. People in the current era, speaking of Twitter, people have tried to cancel Attila many times over the years. But you have always walked away without a scratch, which to me is kind of amazing, because I feel like pretty much everybody in the scene has been canceled at some point or another.
Oh, yeah.
What's your secret?
I don't think there's any secret. I think what it comes down to is anyone that read anything about me or us knows that it's very clearly false and made up. And also from my perspective, it's just one of those things where so many people already hated me and Attila anyways. Right. So the only people that were really barking and being like, fuck Franz, whatever, they already hated me to begin with.
Yes.
They never went to a concert. They never bought a t-shirt. They never supported me or Attila to begin with. So it really just didn't matter, because Attila's used to so much hate that what's more hate? It's just people will say anything and make up anything about people they hate. So it just doesn't matter. And I guess maybe we're just more well-conditioned for it.
And these people only have power if you give them power. Like if you want their approval and start groveling and apologizing and trying to make them like you, that's when they dig in deeper and they're never going to like you.
Oh, yeah. It's the same thing that, you know, my parents used to tell me when I was young. Like, if there's someone picking on you constantly, if you show them attention or show them that it affects you, they're going to keep doing it. But if you just ignore any negativity and hate, it just goes away.
I've really felt this in the past year or two, I guess, because, you know, I've gotten, you know, big enough that I feel like there's a certain point that, like, once you start getting successful enough, the default opinion starts to flip, where like they liked you when you were small, and then when you get bigger, it flips, and the default opinion is they hate you. And, you know, there's been weeks where there's like three threads about me on Reddit, you know, with hundreds of replies about what a horrible person I am, and how I believe this and that, and everyone hates blah, blah, blah. And at first it kind of stressed me out and like upset me. And then I realized it makes no fucking difference to like how many views I get and how much money I make. And nobody gives a shit what these people think other than the other people in their little fucking echo chamber where they smell each other's farts. Nobody else gives a fuck.
No. And I think that's something I also have to remind like friends of mine or like other people in the industry that are worried about stuff. I'm just like, look, the people that are talking bad on Twitter, the people that have the loudest mouths represent the smallest percentage of people.
Yes.
Because the people that actually support you and fuck with you, they're not tweeting you every day talking about how much they fuck with you. They just show up to shows. They buy your ticket, shut up. They shut up, buy your ticket, come to your shows, have a good time, buy a shirt and go home. And it's the loudest mouth people represent the tiniest amount.
Absolutely.
Of real people.
And I think anybody else, these are the people that are looking for the worst in everybody and everything. And they're going to take everything you say in the worst possible intentions. And I think anybody else can see, I mean, obviously you've said some things in songs that, you know, are a little bit edgy, but anybody can tell it's a fucking joke. Like, it's obvious.
Yeah, exactly. And these people that are, you know, trying to burn everyone at the stake are the same people that want, you know, prison reform. They want people to get better. And it's like, why don't you apply that same logic? Because at the end of the day, all musicians are just regular human beings and everyone makes mistakes, no matter what kind of human you are or what profession you chose. So rather than I think it's more of like a power trip, power hungry thing from nobodies that don't have any limelight on them versus actually trying to help people. Because I think it would be more noble if people were, I guess, instead of trying to cancel people and hurt people's careers, if people would just be like, hey, we think that you did something wrong and like we want to see you get better, you know, because I think if it was something like that, I think a lot of these musicians out here would be like, be more willing to hold themselves accountable and be like, you're right. Like, you know, I did make a mistake and I promise to be better and I'm going to, you know, make changes. And I think that's more of a positive, like uplifting, building energy that would probably help out the community more.
Well, they don't want to help people.
No,
that's the thing.
They just want to burn people at the stake.
It's a power trip. That's all it is. It's a shakedown. That's what it is. They want to see if they can get Franz to grovel and beg for forgiveness.
Yeah, and
not gonna happen.
No.
Well, you did have that song Call Out. We had two Call Out songs, but Call Out 2, I thought was the funnier one. You dissed like Bad Baby and Tim Lambesis and Asking Alexandria, Jeffree Star, and probably 20 other people. How much of that was serious, and did you actually piss anybody off with that?
That Call Out 2 was, I don't even know how to explain it, but that was, I guess, like a song gone wrong, I suppose, because here's the issue with Call Out 2, and it took us to release it before we found out, but basically a lot of the people I called out in Call Out 2 were friends where it was just funny, and I hit them up in advance and I was just like, hey, like, we're writing Call Out 2, blah blah blah.
But some of them were serious also.
But some of them
kind of serious.
Some of them were serious, and that's where I fucked up, is because when you have this Call Out 2 and some of it is serious and some of it is just having fun and talking shit about my friends, that caused a lot of confusion, because I realize it now, but you can't really mix like serious and funny. So
it's like you're putting me in the same bucket as Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein or whoever it was.
Exactly. Which I see, that's the problem, is we jumped in the studio, we fucking wrote that song like in less than an hour. You know, it was on a whim. We just sat there and we're like, fuck it, let's go, blah 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 blah, done. So that's something that should have been more thought out, to where we either said, hey, for Call Out 2, let's go the fully serious route, or let's go like fun joking right. route and not mix the two. So that's where we failed with that one, because even though, like I said, I did contact friends of mine that were in the song and it was all fine, it did make people upset, even right. though it was already talked about, and it kind of created, I guess, like a weird energy or weird vibe with some friends. And it was I would just say it's a learning experience.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure they'll get over it. They'll be fine.
Yeah, they're fine. It's all good.
Yeah. You mentioned Warped Tour before, and you know, the more time goes on since, I think the last one was what, 2018, I think, 2017.
Yeah.
The more time without Warped Tour, the more I kind of realize that I think losing Warped Tour was a big part of why the scene has been kind of flat for a while. And I seem to remember that there was like, you were talking about buying the name or something a while ago. Whatever happened with that?
So this is probably the number one question I get asked.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Every day on Twitter, any social media, everyone brings it up. The story is that the last Warped Tour that Attila did, which I believe was 2017, there was a night in San Diego where Kevin Lyman came up to me and he was just like, "Franz, do you want to buy Warped Tour from me?" Very serious.
Okay.
And I was like, my jaw dropped and I was like, yeah. But I didn't have like probably the amount of money he wanted. Yeah. I didn't know what it was at the time, but I was just,
it's not a small amount of money, I'm sure.
No, but I know from his perspective,
but he would probably also rather it be in someone's hands that would do, you know, take care of it.
Yeah, of course. And I think that's why he offered that to me, is because still to this day, if you ask Kevin Lyman, I was the only band member that was awake like at sunrise every morning working, because I had my stay sick tent on Warped Tour. So I would wake up at sunrise and help my dude like set everything up and get everything in order. And he really admired my work ethic and how much I loved music, but I was also willing to work hard every single day.
Right.
So I think that's why, because he always said to me, he's like, "You're the only person in a band that wakes up that early. Everyone else wakes up like, you know," I was the only person in a band on Warped Tour that would go get breakfast, you know.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too, to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like, I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
Oh, it was right. Just crew dudes only. So he noticed that. And that's, I think from his perspective too, being like his, from an older generation, he wasn't used to all of this social media hate on Twitter and stuff,
right,
because
right.
he took everything to heart, because Warped Tour is his baby. So people talking shit on Twitter, you know, "I'm mad about this, I'm mad about this," at Kevin Lyman. He would read and reply to every single tweet. And we're talking about hundreds a day of just,
which in hindsight, like, it's cool that he did that, but he probably shouldn't have.
No, it's a good and bad problem to have, but he cared too much and he wanted to please every single person that had a bad tweet. And I think
the harder you try, the more they're going to dig in.
Yeah, because these people were mad about stupid stuff. You know, I'm mad I can't bring this cooler in, like, I don't know, you know, stupid shit. And he took it all to heart, which is good, but he should have just kind of let it go. So I think the social media, like, people bitching kind of weighed in on him and was taking a toll on him. And also, like, the past few Warped Tours we did, there was like, I swear, there was like a town hall meeting every fucking night. Like, okay, we got to kick off Johnny Craig off Warped Tour. Okay, we got to kick this dude off Warped Tour. Like, we got to burn this dude at the stake. And he just didn't fucking care about that shit. It was like, it was just so much stress to him where he was like, I created Warped Tour to have fun and you guys are making this kind of miserable with all this like drama and just all this stuff going on. And at the time also he had his beer company that was highly successful, Saint Archer Brewing. So
I think sold for hundreds of millions of dollars or something.
I don't know if it was like hundreds, but I know tens, at least. I think it was a tens. Big exit.
Yeah,
it was a lot of money. So financially he didn't need Warped Tour, not that he used Warped Tour for financial gains anyways. He just loved Warped Tour, but I think he was just reaching that point where he's just getting older and the amount of stress Warped Tour had against him was not worth, you know, him busting his ass and losing money once in a while on certain dates like Jacksonville or New Mexico. Right. So I think that's kind of where it all stemmed down to, and him contacting me or talking to me in person and being like, hey, do you want to take over Warped Tour? And I was really excited about that idea. And basically what happened is we had a couple like phone meetings to talk about it. COVID happened, so everything shut down. And then the last time I spoke to him about it, he basically said that I think him taking a break away from Warped Tour for a few years allowed him to see how much love there was for Warped Tour in demand.
Yeah.
So I think he is probably going to reintroduce the Warped Tour brand. But he did say that it might not be like a full like countrywide touring festival. So I don't really know exactly what he has planned for Warped Tour, but I do think we'll see it in some kind of dose. So, but you know, if I ever have the opportunity to take over Warped Tour, I 100% am still all in. So it just kind of depends if he's you know, still trying to carry it on or if he trusts me to make it happen, because it would be a full-time job for me, but
totally.
I'd be more than happy to do it because I have a very clear vision of what Warped Tour needs.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Needs to be to thrive.
What, tell me the vision. I'm curious.
So personally, I think that Warped Tour had too many bands and too many dates. So every day that we're playing, you know, it costs a lot of money to set everything up and rent the amphitheater, and paying all these bands. So, my vision is instead of having like 50 or 60 bands where people only care about maybe 15 of them.
Yeah.
Let's have a condensed version of Warped Tour with, let's just say, 20 bands, right? And instead of having 8 stages, let's have 4 stages where they're all back to back, back to back. And
like,
instead
it's cool
of doing
that
amphitheaters,
they had whatever the Fleshlight stage or whatever with, you know, some, you know, unknown local band playing to 7 people. I get that, like, from like the perspective of, you know, that's a cool thing to do. But if you got
Sorry,
rid
that's
of it,
so funny.
I'm glad I made you laugh. But like, if you got rid of that, you know, it's not going to hurt the tour. And honestly, it didn't really do anything for the bands either, because they're playing at 11 a.m. to six people that were their friends anyway. You could just get rid of all that stuff and everyone would be better off for it.
Yeah, you could trim the fat. And yeah. I know that that was like part of what made Warped cool, and is because Kevin had such a big heart that he was all about giving people chances.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Kevin Lyman is one of the last true like punk rock people in the world. Like,
absolutely.
let's give the small man a chance. Come on Warped Tour. He's so sick for that. But from a business mindset, it doesn't make sense to have, you know, purple skin donkeys playing, you know, that.
And it's a different world now. Shit is so much more expensive. You know, just the cost of touring and shit is crazy now. Like, you just can't do things the same way. But
yeah,
I do hope it comes back. And, you know, you think about, I don't know, whatever, in the mid-2000s to mid-2010s, you had Ozfest, Mayhem, Summer Slaughter, Warped Tour. Like, that shit was cool. And I think that's a huge part of why the scene was so healthy during that time.
100%. Think about it. Warped Tour was only like $40 a ticket, and you got to see a shitload of bands and
meet them.
Yeah, it was an experience that can never be replicated unless Warped Tour comes back.
Yeah.
So just for me too, like I went to Warped Tour in 2003, I think, a long time ago, and that day changed my life, because I had just became a huge fan of Coheed and Cambria. They just released In Keeping Secrets of Silent Earth 3. And I went to their tent during the meet and greet and bought the CD. And I'm like 100 people back in line. And someone from Coheed's crew comes up to me and they were like, "You bought the CD? No way." And I'm like, "Yeah, of course, duh." And they're like, "Come to the front of the line." And they just passed me past everyone. And I was like, that's crazy that it's such a big deal that I bought a CD, but now I get to meet the band and all this stuff. And I just thought it was the coolest shit ever. And it really opened my, it gave me a whole different type of passion for music. Cause at the time it was like a year before I started Attila. So it gave me a goal to reach for, like, I want to start a band. I want to do this. I want to be on Warped Tour. And I think it's kind of depressing that this generation doesn't get to experience Warped Tour.
Yeah, I mean, now it's like, I guess you hope to blow up on TikTok. I guess that's like what people dream of now, which is, you know, that's cool, but it's not really the same.
Yeah, I'm too old to learn TikTok dances, man.
I'm still dabbing. Now that I'm going to be a dad in a couple days, I'm going to start dabbing just so, because I want to be a good solid 3 to 5 years behind the trends at all times to make sure that I'm embarrassing the shit out of my son.
Oh, amazing. Go ahead and start planking too while you're at
it. Yeah, exactly. Plank, I'll do the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, Coney 2012. That's what I'm here for.
Oh, man, that's great.
Bring back the old days. Well, speaking of that, I always kind of wonder why there aren't more people in the scene who follow kind of your model as far as being entrepreneurial, because it's like, I feel like there's never been a better time to do all of this with social media and Shopify. And like, if you have a phone, you can kind of do whatever you want, but people don't do that. And you're proof of that, but people don't do it. And then they just bitch about money and how the system and blah, 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 you know. And to me, it's just mindset that they have these self-limiting beliefs and you don't. What do you think about that?
I wish that a lot of my friends that are also in bands would adopt my mindset or try to do things for themselves that would help them push outside their limits. I think what it comes down to, because I have thought about this a lot, being musically talented is kind of a rare thing to have.
Yeah.
And it's even,
and it makes you in every other way.
Yeah. I've very rarely met anyone that's good at music and good at business.
Yeah.
It's one or the other.
Yep.
And it's very rarely both. And I think that I'm just one of those rare individuals where I'm super business oriented, but I also love making music. But I've tried to help friends out, like, yo, dude, like, you know, people love what you play on guitar, like do a tab book or, you know, do this or do that or start this. And I think a lot of people, they'll have the ideas like, oh, I want to do this. I know it would be big, but they lack the execution.
Yeah.
because I think a lot of people are scared of failure, or they just don't want to jump in and do it. And I think that's a big factor too. But it's hard, because I mean, even if you're in a successful band, you still don't make that much money.
Right.
You know, it's possible to be in a successful band and have like a very like basic car, like basic house, if you're really killing it. But to get like, if you really want to create like security, financial freedom for you and your family, there's almost no way to do it strictly off music. You really have to branch out.
I make more money from YouTube than almost anybody in a metalcore band.
Oh, hands down. And we've even toured with bands as Attila, where we're the opener, like long time ago, we're the opener and they're the headliner, and we walk home with more money than them because they're just so bad at money management. Like, let's get three buses, let's get fire and all this crazy production stuff and blow all this money. And it's like, do you guys not want to pay your bills when you get home?
Yeah.
Because I shouldn't be making more money than you. We just budget our money better.
Right. Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like, it's very rare to be good at, you know, more than one thing. You know, you look at, I mean, Periphery to me is the best example of this. Great musicians, great business people. And that's the reason why, you know, Periphery's, they're not a small band, but they're not a huge band.
Oh, they're all rich. They're a great example, because look at Misha. Everyone loves and admires his skills, and he fucking capitalizes off of it.
Yep.
Not in like a greedy way, but he's giving people what they want. And if there's a demand, like if you're that good at guitar and people want to buy your signature guitar, they want to buy your tab books, they want to do all this stuff, provide it for them. And I think
they'll love it.
A lot of people are just lazy too. Like they could spend the extra effort to do this extra stuff that would create a lot of income for them. They just don't do it.
So for someone who maybe recognizes like, okay, I'm that person, what would you say to that? Not the lazy person, but the person who just sort of realizes I don't really have that skill set. What would your advice be to that person?
Like, they don't have the skill set to do like business stuff?
Yeah.
I would just say it's easier than you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't know unless you try. And the problem is a lot of people just don't try. And then the other bit of advice I always give everyone is don't ever expect overnight money. That doesn't exist. Plan on sticking with it and hitting it hard for at least a couple years. And then maybe in 2 or 3 years, you'll see some money. So don't expect money immediately. Be patient. And you have to try. If you have an idea for a business or something that you know, is symbiotic to what you're doing as a musician, then do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'll give you an example right now. Just before this interview, I ran to the dealership and I bought a 15-passenger van because tomorrow I'm going to buy a trailer. It's because I know that there's so many bands that I know personally in Florida that can't find vans and trailers to rent for tour. So I just purchased this van. I can rent it out to my friends' bands. And I'll have the entire van paid off in 6 to 8 months. So then after that, the next few years, I just get free income for nothing. Like, I'm just constantly thinking of new ways to bring in income, whether it's small or big or what it is. But a lot of people just don't think about these things.
Yeah. And there's risk there. You know, you might also lose your ass because maybe the, you know, market changes in 6 months and maybe you're going to be left holding the bag. There's always risk.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know until you try.
Exactly. And I've made expensive business mistakes in 2000. I don't know, 15, I think I created a social media app called Spur. And
I remember that.
I invested over $30,000 into making this app happen with development and employees and whatnot. And then it failed, but it was a $30,000 like learning curve for me. Cause I gained a lot of knowledge from that mistake, and I would have never known unless I tried. So it's something that I could have lived my whole life being like, I regret not trying. I tried and failed and I didn't want to lose over 30 grand, but I got smarter as a result of it. So I'm happy I did it.
The point about delayed gratification, I think, is such an important one, because very few businesses, you know, are making a lot of money from day one. Like, it takes years from YouTube. I didn't make any real money from YouTube for like maybe 2 years. And then I started making like $1,000 or $2,000 a month, which is cool. But, you know, obviously that's not enough to like pay any kind of bills or something like that. It wasn't until maybe 4 years into it that it actually, you know, because every video makes money every day. And the more videos you have, the more that sort of income keeps coming in every day. And it wasn't until, you know, probably 3 or 4 years into it that I was like, all right, this is starting to actually add up. And you see a lot of people start something like a podcast or whatever it is, and they give up after 3 months. And it's like, well, of course nothing came of this because you only did it for 3 months.
Exactly. People aren't patient enough because they see other people succeeding and they want that instant gratification. Like, I can't tell you how many people have started clothing lines because I started Stay Sick, but I'm talking, I could name over 10 people.
Sure.
And most of these people, same exact thing, started their clothing company, super excited, 3 months in, gone. Social's gone, everything doesn't exist anymore. It's because people want that instant gratification and they don't realize it takes time. Because like, much like you said, when I started Stay Sick Clothing, I didn't make any money for the first 2 years. And then out of nowhere, it was like year three-ish, it was like, boom, I made money. And it was like, cool, my patience paid off.
Yep, yep. Well, on that note, one thing that I think is really underrated about Attila is that, you know, you have a lot of silly songs and stuff, but I think you have a lot of, you know, well, maybe not a lot, but you have like plenty of serious lyrics that I think people kind of sleep on. For example, my favorite one is Rise Up, which I think is a really like empowering, super positive song. Can you talk a little bit about the message behind that song?
Yeah. So Rise Up is kind of just encouraging people to take control of their life and build themselves a better future and break out of the system that wants them to just be stuck in a 9-to-5. And yeah, I haven't heard anyone mention that song in forever, but you're right. It's
I love
a good
that
song. Yeah.
Yeah. I forget. I'm not very good at remembering the exact lyrics, but I remember reading that. I was like, man, this reminds me of like Terror or something. This is cool.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And it's kind of, there's been serious Attila songs all throughout our career. They just always get swept under the rug because people love the suck my fuck, you know, fuck this, fuck that more than the serious songs. But there still are some people that appreciate it. So it always makes me happy to hear.
But if all you did was serious songs, then probably a lot less people would know the band. And, you know, it's kind of like it's like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. That's how I think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Try to sneak that stuff in there. Last question I have for you. Very important question. If you could get with anyone on your OnlyFans, who would it be? But it has to be a guy.
I'm probably going to answer this one pretty quick. I would say Ryan Gosling.
Okay.
I love him.
Not. I was thinking Brian Starrs.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ. Nightmare.
No. Okay, cool. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks again for everything. And I will see you on the tour.
Yeah. About That Life tour, September to October. We're playing About That Life front to back. So everyone watching, make sure you grab tickets because the tour will sell out.
Right on. Take care. Bye.
All right. Thank you.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake and host of Krista Makes a Podcast. A songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.